What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. This episode was recorded Wednesday, the day the music died, by which I mean the day that Bernie Sanders suspended his campaign. And I speak to media critic Adam Johnson. He's also the co-host of the podcast Citations Needed. Then I speak to Tiffany Caban, public defender and former candidate for Queen CA. And then I have a bonus interview with writer Malaika Jabali. So make sure after you hear the end of the radio show, you stick around for that chat with Malaika Jabali.
Hi, everyone. Hello, everyone. Can you believe how chipper I sound? Despite the announcement that we have to deal with. I'm going to keep things really fast. This is the Katie Halper Show. You can listen to the Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 4 p.m. on WBI. That's 99.5 FM or WBI.org. And I'm keeping it fast. Hi, Reggie. Hi, everyone. We got a guest who can only be with us for a little bit. So without any further delay, I'm presenting, bringing to talk to us, Adam Johnson, the co-host of the Citations Needed podcast, media critic extraordinaire, and you can also find him at The Appeal. So, Adam, welcome.
Hi, Katie. How are you doing?
I've been better. Between a lot of things going on, I've been better. How are you? Yeah.
I'm well, relatively speaking. I guess I'm employed, so that's better than a lot of people can say.
And you're healthy?
I do not have the Rona as of yet, or at least not that I'm aware of. I suppose I don't know.
Right.
I guess it's kind of like a Roninger's tat, if you will. You never quite know.
Right.
Please punch me for that. Yeah. You never quite know if you have it, but I feel healthy, and God willing, we'll not get it anytime soon.
Inshallah. Also, because we're about to be talking about a major announcement, I just want to remind you, no cursing. Okay.
Yes.
That's probably more for me than for you.
Helpful.
That's helpful, right?
So thank you.
Thank you.
Adam, this is Reggie. By the way,
people know I'm edgy.
They won't know.
Hi, Reggie.
Oh, that rhymes.
How are you doing?
How will they know you're edgy once I introduce you to Reggie? Adam, just tell us the news, please. I can't say it.
The news that Bernie Sanders has officially suspended his campaign for president.
Yep.
That news.
Yep.
So yeah, he did. Obviously, we saw this coming for some time now. This was pretty much a formality. I think it was pretty much clear after Super Tuesday that this was where this was going to end up, which is good. You know, you want it to be it was sort of a slow descent, which is always better than a harsh or immediate one. It's probably good. It won't drag on for months like it did in 2016. I don't think that was very fruitful, although I understood why it did, because it was a close race. But this race was decided a month ago.
Really?
So
he could have still gotten it. No, I mean, it would have taken a lot of. So why do you think he dropped out the moment he did?
Well, I mean, the world changed, 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, right? So yes. There was all these different factors. This has been a volatile race from the beginning. Things have shifted. It's just that for whatever reason, a lot of the kind of electability, psychology, and tautology that's pushed on people worked. Biden has generally high favorables. He's associated with an administration that still has very high favorables. Those things were hard to overcome. you know, Biden is uniquely uniquely positioned to, unlike everyone else, to beat Sanders, because he did well in the demographics. He did well and he held his own with Latinos. He won poor white men, which Bernie did well with and Biden does better with now. So it was never the demographics, just the math was never there after the party elites coalesced around Biden and CNN and MSNBC ran effectively ran a 72-hour Biden infomercial leading up to Super Tuesday, between South Carolina and Super Tuesday, which is really why the part where the whole election was decided that weekend, that Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. And there was no way that you can really get over that. I mean, and of course, Biden was handled with kid gloves when it came to his speech issues and sexual harassment and assault allegations that I don't think would have been afforded to Sanders. Whether or not it's fair to bring those up with Biden is a separate question, but I don't think I think it's fair to assume that none of this generous media coverage would have been afforded to Sanders. So those all that things combined, and of course Sanders himself, I'm sure we can sort of go back and debate what the campaign did wrong vis-a-vis African-American support in the South, which was pretty dispositive, at least from a narrative perspective, all we want. So I don't know. But of course, it wasn't just that. It was also Biden was beating Sanders with white voters that he had won last time. Again, different reasons why that is. It's mostly because Biden is associated with the most popular Democrat in the world, which is Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And that's hard. That's hard to beat. Clinton never really had that association, and indeed, in many ways, was seen as being adversarial to Obama.
And you tweeted today, it's kind of pat, but I think what went wrong takes are mostly people just projecting pre-existing navel-gazy grievances onto a campaign. Around the margins, these things matter, but it was always 90% a media that is systematically hostile to anything left of the New York Times editorial page. So that's the big takeaway, right? That it was the media.
Well, I mean, again, I fully acknowledge that this is very pat, and this kind of, in some ways, is pandering a little bit, right? But I really think that the way I view this stuff, and I had the same response when Corbyn lost, is I think having a critical analysis of what the campaign did wrong is perfectly fine. But if you're not contextualizing that,
right,
and what the tremendous forces are for an insurgent campaign that's hostile to the Democratic Party elite and the corporate media and speaks about them in those terms, if your solution, which in 95%, I'm pulling these numbers out of my ass, or sorry, my butt, sorry.
That's okay.
But 95% of these takes are basically just Bernie Sanders should have been more like Elizabeth Warren, which is to say that
more Native American, you mean?
Well, they should have kissed the ring, et cetera. But the problem with that is that Elizabeth Warren finished third in her home state. So I'm not sure how that works either. And basically, I really think it's people who have pre-existing grievances projecting those kind of analysis. And the way I view this, and the way I viewed it after Corbyn, is I really think that electoral leftism, which I want to be clear is not the totality of leftism. There are plenty of people who wake up every day who have nothing to do with the Sanders campaign, with different tendencies, abolitionists, anarchists, socialists, etc., who are not part of the electoral system, who wake up every single day and go do all the hard work in their communities, prisons, etc. But if you're with a specific focus on electoralism, and I do think the kind of broader left, as it were, both electoral and non-electoral, is to me the take home is that we need to do I think the most constructive way of doing this is to talk about, and this is going to sound a little lofty, but indulge me, is building alternative narratives and media and cultural products. So much of what Sanders came up against and other Dem socks who were running the future will come up against.
That's Democratic Socialist for listeners.
Is these kind of tropes that you have to spend all your time unpacking. So, for example, how are you going to pay for it? Electability, these kind of zombie concepts that are very difficult to unpack in a soundbite driven media, that I think we need to think hard and deep about what are ways we can create popular. This is, by the way, what the right wing did in the late 70s when they effectively all the far right and billionaires got together and decided they were going to fund an entire ecosystem of think tanks to do this. And of course, they have an advantage because they have the money. I'm not suggesting that the left or whatever can do the same thing because they just don't have the resources.
Right.
But I do think we need to think critically about how we can start to deconstruct. And this, of course, is what we try to do on our show. And I know that you try to do often. How do you sort of deconstruct the mentality that makes offering people basic social democracy so difficult in this scenario?
Yeah.
Now, you obviously have tremendous barriers with corporate media. You have tremendous barriers with editorial pages. But thinking of ways of deconstructing that and coming up with counter narratives. And I think, quite frankly, there needs to be more cultural products. There needs to be more left-wing film and television.
Yeah, definitely.
And there really isn't any, because so much of that, and this, again, this may seem a little bit lofty compared to what, how most people are addressing this now, but I think without that approach, I don't think there's, it's going to be almost virtually impossible to really ever win on a massive scale to build mass movements, because the deck is so stacked against you.
Right, so we need propaganda, and effective propaganda.
You need effective propaganda. And I think that, Bernie Sanders was a once in a lifetime politician.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy whose approval ratings in Vermont were Saddam Hussein numbers.
And they did the same thing to him.
Well, yeah. Well, I think this is a little more organic.
Yeah.
But the point is that this was someone who was in the 80s percentile, sort of very popular, appealed to moderates, this and that, obviously had a benefit of being a white male or perceived as being a white male, that other candidates didn't have, for worse. But, so this was a perfect storm of things that came together, and there was still there was all this insuperable, mechanisms in place, which is not to say that the campaign itself is not responsible. Ultimately, it has to be. But I do think one is deluding themselves to think that if only people were nicer on Twitter
I
think this is kind of, and again, I know it's pat and I know it's somewhat self-serving, but I really do believe it, that I think that these are ultimately not very knowable things. Whereas I feel like a constructive sit back, look at the 30,000 feet about the way people perceive the unions, the way people perceive climate change, the way that people perceive the sort of debt fetishism about how are you going to pay for it. All these things are massive barriers to meaningful progressive politics.
Right.
And I think until you really sit back and think about ways you can deconstruct those things, you're never really going to. And by the way, people in prison abolition and prison reform have come up against this a lot. I work at The Appeal, and you see this all the time with how do you get people to understand the moral stakes of prison? Well, okay, for years, all we had was law and order, cops, cops, law and order, cops, cops, and cops. And then so the first actual real cultural product, at least that I've seen, that gave a sense of what the stakes, moral stakes were in prison, was a show like When They See Us or Netflix is 13, was the first
That's
thing that really,
yeah.
And then these things become shorthand, and then you start to sort of erode the culture around that. And now you have people like, Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren and you sort of mainstream Democrats coming out and demanding people get released from prison.
Right.
And I think that that's not something you would have seen. You would have seen 3-4 years ago. And I do think now that had some money behind it. There are reasons why that is. But I think that things like media analysis, cultural criticism, culture itself, media products, knowledge products, God forbid, I mean, even sort of crowdsource funded think tanks, I think are really the thing we should be talking about now, not projecting our own grievances onto what our sort of pre-existing grievances are. And people would say, well, that was your pre-existing thing was media narratives.
Right.
Which is true, of course, because that's what I do for a living.
Right.
But I think it's pre-existing for a reason, because we all knew going into this, and this is kind of an axiom of left-wing politics, that the media is going to rig things against you. Because that's the primary social function of media. And if one doesn't believe that the media is out to get left-wing candidates, then I would assume one is not really left-wing to begin with, since it's kind of an axiom of class analysis that the media does not exist separate from class interest.
And why, I don't know how much time you have left, Adam. Do you have to?
I got a couple more minutes.
Okay. Why does
Sorry to be Hollywood, I just get it.
It's very Hollywood, yeah. Why does the media hate Sanders? What are the concrete? I mean, I spend so much time on my shows and in my writing, kind of tracing the media biases or documenting them. But why do they hate him?
why does a newspaper owned by the first and second richest person in the world, yes, which is Bezos and Carlos Slim, the Washington Post, the New York Times, why do they hate someone who speaks openly in class war terms?
Yeah.
Even if superficially. I mean, I don't know, one can sort of venture to guess.
Right. Okay. So it's
why does a dog hate cats? Why do cats hate mice? I mean, it seems rather obvious to me, but.
And like MSNBC people, why do they hate him? Is it also just a direct tax issue?
It's Comcast. I mean, I don't know. They're corporations. The corporations are inherently reactionary, ideologically speaking.
Right.
Of course.
So it's not necessarily, I mean, do you think it's
in general, obviously there are exceptions, I don't have 90 seconds. I can't really get into ecology of corporate media, but suffice to say that.
You want to put blame on anyone in particular?
Suffice to say that these things are extremely documentable.
Right. Well, I know.
Sorry.
Do you want to name any people you want to blame? Any targets you want to?
Yeah, I think specifically I think specifically it was Bernie Stan 69420. Who tweeted a snake emoji. I think they're definitely to blame.
And forced Elizabeth Warren to not oppose Joe Biden anymore. Yeah.
Yeah, this is definitely a plausible reading of events that definitely doesn't just get everyone off the hook.
Yeah.
Look, I think that internally there are things we can sort of debate that should or should not have happened, a sort of tone or approach, I suppose. But ultimately, I think those things are cosmetic compared to the broader issues of, like, how do you push back against a kind of conservative and right-wing media apparatus that has exists in this country way more than other countries. I mean, you can do A/B tests on how modest democratic, social democratic policies are received in certain countries versus others. And it's very endemic in our culture, and it's very difficult to deconstruct.
Yeah. All right. Well, Adam, any final words? I don't want to keep you. I know you're very Hollywood. You have a bunch of meetings. That's it. All right.
Yep.
And all right. Thank you so much, Adam Johnson. Where can people find you on Twitter? Adam Johnson NYC. Your podcast Citations Needed. Where else?
That's it.
Okay. That's it. Awesome.
All right.
Thank you so much, Adam Johnson. Bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Come back soon. And really excited to be joined once again by Tiffany Caban, who is a raging against the machine, former Queens DA candidate, currently working for Working Families, always public defender. Queer Latina decarceral. So, anything else that I'm leaving out from this Renaissance woman of criminal justice bio?
What's going on, Katie?
How are you?
I'm all right. I think you hit it all, though.
Okay,
proud dog mom. Like, that's
proud
probably
dog mom. Yes. Okay, cool. I'm a dog sister. My parents have a dog, so I'm a dog older sister. How are you?
Hanging in,
yeah.
You know, like, thankful for my health, obviously, but it's an adjustment, and like Queens is kind of becoming the epicenter of it all, so it's hard.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
What are you working on now? Because we had you on before your DA race, and which you, I still consider you the Queens DA. but what are you up to now? Since you,
so I am. Well, a lot of things, but like primarily I am a national political organizer with the Working Families Party. And it was just like the perfectly timed opportunity after my race, after not just the primary, but the recount and the lawsuit, right. I like just didn't know what to do with myself. I knew I wanted to keep working and moving. And so I had like flown myself out to go support Chase Boudin, who is now the DA in San Francisco, yes, which is incredible.
So exciting, yeah.
And is doing incredible things. And, you know, when I came back, I connected with Maurice Mitchell, the head of the Working Families Party. And, you know, they're building out this beautiful, beautiful criminal justice program. And so now I feel like I've gotten the opportunity to take my platform, our campaign, our organizing model, and scale it nationally, because we are working across the board to elect decarceral DAs across the country. So we worked on Chase's campaign. We worked very hard on Kim Fox's reelection, as well as Jose Garza in Austin, who's he's on his way to winning. He won the popular vote. They've got a run out there. So we're continuing to make sure we get him over the finish line. And now just really organizing with my comrades and community members around how do we get folks out of jail right now?
Yeah. And we're going to talk about that more. I just wanted to ask you, as someone who is an insurgent candidate who came very close to winning, how do you deal with, what's your advice for those of us who are dealing with the sad news about Sanders suspending his campaign?
You know, it is a really sad and hard day, but I think that we have a lot to be proud of. I mean, that message of like, not me, us is couldn't be more important than this moment. But I've said it about my race, and I will say it about the Sanders campaign is like, you know, as hard as it is, even when we lose, we win. And we won on a lot of the issues. I think what we're building is very, very powerful, and we're going to continue to grow it. And to know that, you know, it doesn't stop with just the presidential, like the infrastructure of that campaign. We are people that are organizing around so many different things. And now it's about focusing on building that bench, right? So that we can eventually have that kind of success on the presidential scale. But we need it at every level of our government to create the kind of political will we need to get that kind of power.
Yeah. Where were you when you found out? How'd you respond?
Oh, gosh. So I actually was on I found out I guess a few minutes late, really, because I was on a conference work call. You know, the campaign work does not stop.
Right.
And it was just sort of, it was just sort of devastated by it. But, you know, I think it's also really, really important that we make it clear that the progressive vote has to be earned.
Yeah.
And that means adopting a lot of, you know, Medicare for all and a Green New Deal and all of these things that are really, really important. But then also took a minute to, again, be thankful. I am super grateful for, you know, Bernie Sanders, his decades and decades of work fighting for people on the margins and for like being consistent and like a point of very clear moral clarity, essentially. Right. And so, you know, just taking a moment to also be grateful for that as well.
Yeah. I was taping my other podcast, Useful Idiots, that I do with Matt Taibbi, and I saw a text while we were taping it. And so now I'm like caught on video and on audio kind of being stunned. I feel more numb, kind of. I wasn't that surprised, but for some reason, I thought that, I thought there'd be more of a hint that it was happening. I mean, I saw him and his great, like, surrogates and great press secretary, Breonna Joy Gray, just last night doing a roundtable about how COVID-19 is affecting Black people in particular. And that's a great transition I want to ask you about. What are you working on now with COVID-19 and how that's intersecting with criminal justice issues? And is this this seems like a crisis and maybe an opportunity?
Yeah, I think by definition, every crisis is an opportunity because at its root, it is a turning point. And it is historically the moment where we have the best opportunity to radicalize on either side, right? And so like it is for, you know, it is incumbent upon us as the left to take advantage of this moment because, you know, it's incredible to see all of the things that like directly impacted and working class folks have been saying and demanding and begging for. And now all of a sudden, we've been told for so long we can't have it, and the government is giving it to us, right? And to make sure that this isn't like a one-off, a one-stop, but saying, hey, like this is more reflective of the faults of our government infrastructure in general, the fact that we don't have social safety nets and all of these different things. So we needed to take advantage of this moment for sure. And then, you know, a lot of the work has been making sure that we are centering the people that are too often left behind. If New York City and then Queens is the epicenter of the COVID pandemic in the United States, Rikers Island certainly is like at the very, very center of it. I mean, we're talking about infection rates that are, you know, 70 times what it is around the country and certainly 7 to 9 times what it is in the city. And, you know, this is, our prison industrial complex has always been a public health crisis, but like it is just that much easier and so much more clear for folks who maybe necessarily don't really touch the system or haven't been as aware to see that now as well. Right. And there's a lot that's not being done.
Yeah. And what are you, what is decarceral justice? I mean, you talked about this a little bit on the last show, and I just think it's really important for listeners to understand and what can be done now with that. I mean, we see people trying to let people, to decarcerate people because of the infection rates. What's happening at different locations around the country? I saw Larry Krasner talk about this, but.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, just to frame it in terms of decarceral prosecution and decarceral politics in general, is that like we should be moving towards being motivated by just the best public health and public safety outcomes. And so that in effect means shrinking right. our carceral system, shrinking our urge to punish rather than to provide supports, change behavior, and actually have better, safer, healthier outcomes. And so what we're seeing around the country around COVID in jails and prisons is that this isn't a one-off that's happening in cities or like this is happening everywhere. People are acting. And it's not just Larry Krasner and Chase, and I do want to talk about them specifically, but you have in places like Montana, LA, Hawaii, New Jersey, all retaining folks who are incarcerated, understanding that it is the best way to save lives. You know, it certainly being incarcerated should not under any means be a potential death sentence, right. Especially, I mean, and not anywhere, right? Like I am, you know, anti-death penalty, anti-death yeah. by incarceration, right. like all of it. But here particularly, it's particularly shameful in New York because we don't have the death penalty,
right.
specifically because we have decided collectively that that is cruel and unusual punishment. And so to see people on Rikers Island who are pretrial detainees, people who are there because they cannot afford their bail, people who are there because of technical violations of parole, have not committed crimes, people who are there for serving sentences for low-level offenses, right, for misdemeanors, every single person sitting on that island is exposed to a death penalty. And we don't accept that or demand that even of the most heinous crimes
right.
here in New York.
Right.
So just putting that framing on it. But, you know, I think part of the failure of our response here in New York is the way that we view the function of our systems.
Right.
And the other side of that is a Chesa Boudin or Larry Krasner or Rachel Rollins. Like they are people who are very rooted and grounded in centering public health and public safety. So they were able to move very quickly into decarcerating because their mindset is already, if it saves lives, it's worth doing and we can right. act fast.
Right.
And we know what kinds of supports we need. Whereas we have the opposite approach. And so we react to things with the police or with more surveillance, state surveillance or state control or punishment. And those things aren't going to get us the results that we need. And we're moving way too quickly, way too slowly to the point where I honestly think it's we're too late. We were too late a long time ago. So we really, really need to be doing a lot more. And it's also laying it's also laying everything bare.
Right, it's unmasking everything.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I thought was wild was our police commissioner saying, we've got 3,000 people calling out sick, but don't worry, we can still fully staff our shifts. And immediately I think to myself, well, if you can fully staff your shifts with 3,000 officers out, maybe we shouldn't have had all of those officers to begin with,
right.
because we don't have safe staffing in our hospitals. We don't have enough nurses. We don't have enough doctors. We don't have enough teachers in our schools. And like, that is exactly the problem.
Right. Yeah. Well, and what do you say to people? I mean, 'cause one of the interesting things is that decarceral justice isn't just something that people like you and me politically find appealing. I mean, it's one of these things that I think just rational people who don't have a particularly progressive worldview, but understand that incarcerating people does not have good effects. Like, even if you don't care about people who the incarcerated people, even if you just have a public safety, you can be conservative, yep. whatever, but they just look at the empirical data and see that it's not actually helpful. But at the same time, it is a very easy talking point to make how can you let people out of jail? They're going to go around and murder people or rob people. So what's your response to that kind of fear mongering that is very, a common trope? Yeah.
The fact of the matter is that 97% of people who end up in a jail cell will reenter their communities at some point. And our system is not set up to make sure that harm doesn't continue, right? So there's a failure on that end already. But also looking at what actually produces safety and what gives us better outcomes. So we know that when people have a place to lay their head down at night, when they have access to healthcare, when they have access to harm reduction services, mental health services. It is the best way to keep people safe and from harming. The other thing too is that our system doesn't really provide justice for survivors, right? And we have created this false kind of dichotomy where survivors are given two options. Either they can do nothing, right? Or the person who harmed them can end up in a jail cell. And it's a really complex thing because within communities, and you know this when you practice in court and things, like the intersection is very real. One day you are the defendant in a case, one day you are the witness, one day you are the victim, the survivor. There are a lot of relationships and community ties at play. And if you ask a survivor or victim, overwhelmingly, when given the choice, a third option, right? The thing that they really want above all else is to make sure that they are made whole and they're not hurt again. And other people aren't hurt in the same way. And so when given the option to have the resources to actually support people who hurt, because hurt people hurt people, not only are the outcomes better, but, you know, again, we can engage in an accountability process that also doesn't strip people of their dignity and their humanity and gives them the opportunity to be able to heal and be able to function in our communities in ways that are less harmful.
Yeah. And that's restorative justice or
trauma-informed Yes, absolutely.
Justice?
Absolutely. I mean, a great model for this is Danielle Sered's program, Common Justice. I mean, they work exclusively with folks who commit violent offenses against others. And it's incredible. They have over a 90% participation rate. It's up to the person who's been hurt, right? The survivor of the victim to decide whether they want to participate in this thing. And they choose it because the outcomes are what's more important. They want to make sure that they're not hurt again and other people aren't hurt again. And it's a really transformative experience for everybody involved. And the recidivism rate is something like less than 5%. So it works. That's the other thing. Like these right. things work.
Right, which is why you have libertarians often supporting it. You know, people who don't have a very
human... Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating. But I want to ask you about someone who's receiving a lot of attention, and I think it's mostly because he's not Trump and he's decisive. And I'm talking about none other than Andrew Cuomo, who's being kind of praised as a hero, and people are thinking about him if and when Joe Biden, whatever, I don't want it, many things could happen with Joe Biden, but people keep talking about him as a potential draftee for the nomination, you know, the Democratic nomination. What do you think about this guy? Is he the champion that people describe him as?
You know, it's really interesting how we sort of like uplift our mayors or our governors in times of crises. And there wasn't a lot of attention actually on what was happening underneath. A lot of folks outside of New York didn't know that while he was keeping a level head in hand in press briefings, was also at the same time calling for major cuts to Medicaid and funding for our hospitals and our schools and how those things don't align. You know, the movement towards the budget, I think, was devastating for a lot of us to see an unwillingness to tax ultra-millionaires and billionaires to make sure that we could keep our hospitals open, given care, or the fact that our response has been what it has been because we didn't have the infrastructure in place. So I think it's really important to be critical of what came before and everything that else that's happening and putting it all in context.
Yeah.
You know, in my mind, I wrote an op-ed about this recently, but our governor and our legislature certainly failed the test of moral clarity when they called for those cuts, when they rolled back bail reform, knowing that bail reform was saving lives. I don't, there's a part of me that almost has to chuckle at it so that I don't scream about it.
Right. It kind of reminds me of, sorry, I cut you off.
Yeah, no. Go ahead.
It kind of reminds me of when Nancy Pelosi ripped up Donald Trump's speech. It's like performative. And in this case, the performative part is just being, I guess, like doing his briefings and, you know, talking the talk and telling people he's Black and Latina and queer and Jewish. I mean, that was funny, that little monologue where he identifies, you know, he multi-identifies, I guess. But very problematic, I know. But like then hiding, you know, behind doing that, and at the same time, like it's, you know, like Thomas Frank has a book, Listen Liberal, and in that book he quotes someone who says it takes a liberal, meaning it takes a liberal in quotes to get certain things passed. Like it was easier for Bill Clinton to do NAFTA because he was a Democrat. And we see this happening with a lot of like centrist Dems and corporate Dems and with Andrew Cuomo. And I mean, can you, something I miss, and the media was talking about a little bit, but was the way that prisoners were inmates were making hand sanitizer that they weren't allowed to use themselves.
Yes.
How does that happen? How is that? And I guess then the argument is like, oh, well, we're paying them something, but what's the response to that?
I mean, first of all, it's slave labor. We're talking about people making pennies an hour to be making this thing that we're using to, you know, keep our community safe, but that people that are incarcerated don't have access to.
Right.
You know, not only do they not have access to it, can't use it, but we're talking about people who can't engage in social distancing at all. My dogs just started barking.
They're so upset. No, it's okay. They're upset.
Yeah,
they are speaking truth. They're barking truth to justice.
Yeah, but people who can't socially distance, that don't, they get one bar of soap to take showers. If they want to get other soap, they have to be able to buy it in the commissary. They don't have easy access to it, and are not able to protect themselves. So it was particularly bad. But if you want to speak for a second, I can quiet my dogs down.
Okay. What, are you going to be like, it's okay, revolution is on the way, don't
worry. I'm gonna mute myself.
Sure, okay.
If you want to talk.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, they probably just heard the news about Bernie. They're upset.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, they have Bernie collars.
Oh my God, can we see them? I mean, I can.
Sure.
Try
wait.
Yeah. Sure.
Well,
yeah,
you can see.
Yeah, you can come.
I'm gonna mute myself.
Okay, great. Reggie, how are you doing? Are you still there, Reggie? Obviously, you're there, right?
Yeah, I am still
this
here.
This is a fascinating. Isn't this a good discussion? Oh my God.
It is a very interesting discussion, and it's very interesting that Tiffany brought out you and Tiffany was mentioning about Cuomo and the theatrics, as you were saying, about during his reports on COVID-19 in the state of New York, where he is giving numbers and statistics and stuff like that, but what a lot of people don't understand, that there was a budget that was finalized last week, and there's a bunch of cuts that are happening that actually contradicts almost everything that Cuomo was talking about on air, but no one knows about that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's you know, Trump's negligence just lets people seem so good, just because, again, you can be decisive and you can do terrible things and people are comforted by it because Trump was so, he just dropped the ball so much.
It's a very low bar.
I know, it's a very low bar, and it's dangerous because then people do look like they're saviors. And I mean, I wanted to ask another question. I wanted to ask you about the elections that were happening, the primaries. When you have primaries that are held during a pandemic and you are obviously putting certain populations at more risk than others, like immunocompromised people or older people, is that a voting rights issue? Is that a disenfranchisement issue?
I mean, absolutely. First of all, to add to sort of how hard this morning has been it coming off of Wisconsin and seeing, one, the low turnout. I think in one of the counties, the turnout was like 3% or something like that. Like, how we can call this a legitimate election in these times is, I don't know how we do that. But beyond that, then asking and calling for people to risk their lives to go out and exercise their right to vote is just sort of horrific. You know, again, we've said this over and over the course of the program, but just laying bare all of the problems with our democracy, why we don't make it easier to vote, why we don't have, you know, automatic voter, why everybody can't vote, all of these different things. And it's it's actually really challenging for the left and particularly like grassroots insurgents, because the way that we win is we out-organize, right? Like we get boots on the ground.
Yeah.
And so this has been a time where we all have collectively been coming together and saying, okay, like how do we change our strategies to reach people? But also I've been really, really, like it's been amazing to see where our folks' priorities are, because what we're seeing, and we saw Bernie Sanders modeled this as well, is that what we're seeing is that we're taking our campaigns and we're turning them into mutual aid networks, right? We are going out and seeing how we can use those same tools to help our neighbors to make sure that they're safe, and then taking the opportunity and saying like, well, this is how we got here. And what are the things that you need? Well, we have candidates out there that want to champion those things. So do you have them, not just today when you're in crisis, but all the time, because this could happen again.
Yeah, I mean, I was really shocked by how, you know, I'm someone who, like you, I think sees there are way too many similarities between the Republicans and Democrats. But I have to say, when Tom Perez and Simone Sanders, who's no relationship to Sanders, except same last name, but Biden's senior advisor, Simone Sanders, when she not only urged people to vote, but said that the CDC had said it was safe for folks to vote, while after... Chris Cuomo literally said the CDC says it's not safe to have more than 50 people together, and she said they've said it's safe. Watching that and watching Tom Perez urge governors not to postpone the elections was so disgusting. And I felt very naive, but I kind of was like, I really didn't think the Dems would do this. Like, I thought this was something the Dems would be like, okay, we're the party of science and medicine, and, you know, we're corporate hawks, but we have some standards. And when they did that, I just was disgusted and I couldn't believe it.
Well, and always, you know, the always it is black and brown working class communities that bear the brunt of it. Because when you talk about who's got to go the farthest to get to their polling station, who has the least amount of machines, who's more likely to have to wait in a line for hours to be able to vote, It's our black and brown and low income and working class communities. And so I think, you know, it's just, it adds to the disenfranchisement of the same people who have historically been disenfranchised. So again, just continuing to lay bare all of the problems
here. They should be all declared illegitimate, all of them. And then we should have a do-over, a mail-in do-over, and Amo Bernie will win. Reggie, can we
he's take Theo Bernie? To
Theo me. Bernie, I know. To me, he'd be, I don't even know how to say uncle in Yiddish. I'll find out. But Tiffany, we only have a few more minutes. Anything that you want to talk about? I mean, I can ask you more questions, of course, but I just want to know if there's anything that's on your mind that you want to make sure we address.
You know, I guess I would just say, I would love to take the time to encourage folks to join their local mutual aid networks. We have one in Queens. There's one in basically every neighborhood that you can kind of get linked into. And just like, if you want to get in on this fight of trying to decarcerate and bring people home because they are sitting ducks in our jails right now, you know, there are our community bail funds that are raising money to bail people out. Check those out and put pressure on like the mayor to put pressure on the police to make changes to how we're policing and engaging with the community, to call up Governor Cuomo's office and say, hey, use your power to grant clemencies and commutations, because he can do that with you know, the stroke of a pen. A lot of people don't know that he made the commitment to release people who are jailed on technical violations, over 600 people, and only 200 have been released. So we need to keep that pressure on. So call up Governor Cuomo, ask for those releases, and, you know, don't let up and just check on your neighbors. I don't know if there's anything else you want to talk about, but check on your neighbors.
We had on Dean Spade last week, who talked about mutual aid, and that's really, how important it is now more than ever. I mean, can we prosecute Tom Perez and Joe Biden maybe for endangering people?
Oh, you know, federal laws is not my specialty. Yeah. You have to find another lawyer for that.
All right, we'll have to do that. Yeah. And are you practicing now? Or are you representing clients? Or are you focusing on organizing?
I am focusing on organizing. I'm not representing clients right now. It's something that, you know, I always say what's nice is that it allows me to move the way that I do, because I love the work so much that I'm like, man, no matter what, I can be completely unapologetic because worst case scenario, I get to go back to representing my clients right. every day.
Right. Do you miss it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Every day. Yeah. And you know, my public defender friends are my family. You know, yeah. we talk all the time and I miss it. I miss the connection. You know, you build very intimate connections and it's a different way of being in the fight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess let's see, I'm trying to think of anything else. Any other encouragement, like as someone, again, who came so close and was so important and shifted the Overton window, what advice do you have for people to how they can kind of keep their heads up at this time?
Just to reiterate that, like, even when you have losses, you win. I think about the fact that, yes, we came up very, very shy with the vote, but we did some incredible things. I look at the organizing table here in Queens, and it looks different now, right? I mean, we built a really, really diverse coalition that connected, you know, upper middle class moms with sex workers yeah. and formerly incarcerated folks and like being in struggle together and fighting for the same things. And these folks, they're still in relationship with one another, still talking. And those are really important things to be doing. And then just to see how we have been able to take it to the national, yeah. you know, talking about decrim on a national level, presidential candidates,
right.
Seeing more decarceral prosecutors get elected. So, yeah. you know, the work continues.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Just what we needed. Tiffany Caban, thank you for joining us. Former DA, candidate for Queens DA, very inspiring organizer, activist, public defender. And you're listening to The Katie Halper Show. Thank you for listening to The Katie Halper Show. You can hear The Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 4 p.m. on WBAI or 99.5 FM or WBAI.org on the internet. And your Twitter handle is?
Tiffany under, what is that?
Underscore
Caban.
Okay, Tiffany underscore Caban. Bye, everyone. See you next week. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye. Bye.
Really excited to be joined by writer and lawyer and activist Malaika Jabali. Welcome.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
Meh, you know, a bit down.
Yeah.
But how are you?
You know, lots of things going on in the world.
Yeah.
Just want to make it.
Yeah. Where were you when you heard that Bernie Sanders was suspending his campaign?
Home.
Yeah.
Surprise.
Right.
Surprise.
I mean, I guess I meant, what were you doing?
Yeah. In a meeting.
I was taping my other podcasts and I think I ruined the whole thing. I was like numb kind of. I feel like I gained like 15 pounds over the last 5 minutes. Just binge eating a bunch of challah, appropriately enough. Yeah.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, it's so good. But I was like, this is so, what a metaphor. You're in Brooklyn?
I am. Hunkered down in Brooklyn.
Well, I've been wanting to have you on for many reasons, but I especially wanted to have you on because of the Wisconsin vote, because you wrote this really wonderful piece called The Color of Economic Anxiety at Current Affairs, one of the places you contribute to. You also write for places like The Guardian. The Guardian, Current Affairs. I want to make sure I get all the... You won a
journalism.
Yes.
The New York Association of Black Journalists.
And that was for that article.
For The Color of Economic Anxiety.
And you made that a film?
Somewhat.
You're on your way.
It inspired a short documentary.
Yeah. But tell us what were your feelings, your thoughts as you saw the Dems, Biden, everyone telling voters in Wisconsin it was safe to vote? How does that kind of intersect with the work that you've done there?
It is disheartening to see attempts to have people who are already vulnerable come out really just for political purposes. Obviously, an election, it's political by nature. But we also have to think about the health outcomes of people and their lives and their well-being. And as I talked about a lot in The Color of Economic Anxiety, which was a focus on Black people in Milwaukee, which is one of the most dire places you can be as a Black person in this country, some of the most dire straits people are in. It has the highest level of segregation in the country, and we know how segregation can affect lots of access to health, adequate health care, adequate education, transit, almost everything you can think of in your lived environment. It has the highest Black male joblessness rate for Black men in their, for men in their prime working year. And so when you see that this community has already been beat down for decades with deindustrialization, and then partisan politics from Republicans to corporate Democrats have affected their lives there, it is just a long line of politicians not really caring enough about the most vulnerable in this country.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because you're also a lawyer. And is this not a voting rights issue and a discrimination issue? I mean, aren't people who have health issues disproportionately affected by having an election during a pandemic?
That would be a new one for me. Unfortunately, I'm not that type of lawyer where I know, you know, ADA issues or 14th Amendment to where I would feel comfortable making any assertions about it. But even if it is legally okay, and I'm assuming that lawyers have looked into this from the campaigns and it went to court. So they attempted to have an injunction and the judge didn't allow it. So, you know, even if there are legal reasons why it's still permissible, ethically, morally, it is awful. It's awful for our democracy. It's awful for the folks who were in lines for hours, potentially, you know, taking, I hate to be so morose, but maybe taking some of their last breath, because this is kind of going through these Black communities in alarming rates.
Right. Yeah. It's have you looked into why it's higher among Black communities? Can you talk about that? Or I don't want to put you on the spot because I don't know if you've actually.
I think that is going to take some academic research to understand, because I think we know the general threads, though. It's some of what I mentioned before in terms of having less access to adequate health care through segregation. So a city, I mean, it's happening in a lot of these Midwestern cities. There's Chicago, there's Detroit, you think about Flint, and in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So a lot of these cities have sort of similar infrastructure when it comes to the rates at which Black people have been shut out of neighborhoods that have adequate health care, that have adequate housing, more environmental justice issues. So these underlying conditions of, you know, racism and racist planning and racist policy ends up having health outcomes as well. And so there's all types of studies and data about that. And it doesn't take, you know, too far of a thread to consider how that can be kind of amplified in a pandemic.
And what do you think about Bernie dropping out? What are your thoughts?
I think most of us, you know, knew that it was going to be a narrow path to victory, just probably right after the consolidation with Super Tuesday. So it's not a surprise. I think it is going to be a big challenge for progressives, for socialists, to determine how we can keep these issues, you know, at the forefront of the party, because they know that they, or to them, they don't need the progressives. They don't need the progressive wing of a Democratic primary. At least Hillary Clinton had to pretend. And so she had to incorporate these things into, you know, the DNC had to incorporate these issues into the platform. It's hard to tell whether or not, you know, as much as we might appreciate moral victories, not being able to have someone to champion those issues is going to make, you know, the next few years a challenge.
Yeah. I don't even know. Do you think Biden can? I mean, who knows? But do you, I feel like he's not going to last till the convention. I mean, I just think he'll reveal himself to be very inarticulate or something. I mean, he was amazingly articulate at that last debate, which surprised me. But for him, like, he didn't have any, as Chris Cuomo said a couple of debates earlier, before that, something like Biden, that was his best debate yet. He was alert the entire time. I mean, I'm not kidding. He actually said that. I just feel like he's not going to be the nominee But of course, they're going to draft someone awful. But assuming he is the nominee, do you think he'll beat Trump? I mean, who knows? You can't predict. But
yeah, really, I really do feel anything could happen. I think we're just in a completely different universe right now with the coronavirus, and Donald Trump is just so incompetent at his job. He has put so many lives in danger that the moderate wing, the moderate, you know, collusion, will probably be pretty fervent over the next several months.
Yeah.
So I think it's totally possible that he could win. None of us know. I mean, I will say that the data is not helpful for him, but it wasn't helpful for him before Super Tuesday either.
Right.
But, you know, in terms of the people who really support Joe Biden, it's a lower percentage than those who supported Hillary Clinton. Like, there was a Washington ABC News poll, Washington Post ABC News poll that came out that showed that the people who really support, you know, they're in the category of highly support a candidate. I'm kind
like
of
enthusiasm.
Yeah, in terms of their enthusiasm, he had a lower rate than Donald Trump and a lower rate than Hillary Clinton did at the same point.
Yeah.
He also has a higher margin between him and Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton did at this point. But again, anything can happen. This, who knew we would be dealing with, you know, stay-at-home orders and a global pandemic. So,
yeah.
Possible.
I'm telling Bernie should just threaten to run third party. He'll never do that. He should run third party or threaten, say, give me the nomination or I'll run third party. He'll never do that, though. I'll pretend I'm Bernie. I'll tell him.
He seems to be more of a party of a player than, you know, like he's willing to play ball with the Democratic establishment more so than the establishment would give him credit for various reasons, and kind of did the same thing when he endorsed Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Yeah.
It's a little absurd the extent of fear mongering that we got about how Trump like he was when it's nothing like that. He aligns with them, you know, frequently enough.
Oh yeah, well, how Trump like he was, yeah, how Trumpian, yeah. Any final words? Any takeaways about Bernie dropping out? About a bunch of people, especially Black low income people, being forced to choose between their life and voting?
We're going to have to take this fight to the streets. That is, you know, and that's even whether Bernie was president or not.
Right.
Local organizations, grassroots organizations are still going to have to fight. They're going to have to fight whether it's a Democrat in office or a Republican office.
Yeah.
And we know that because both Democrats and Republicans have abandoned working class people for decades. And whoever it is, they should be taken to task.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Malaika Jabali, find her on Twitter at...
Did I spell it out?
Yeah.
Malaika Jabali, MalaikaJab as in boy, Ali.
And find her writing, and we'll see you soon.
Wonderful. Thanks.
Great, thank you.
Later.
All right, thanks.
Bye, girl.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to The Katie Helper Show. See you next week. Rate and review us on iTunes. Support the show at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. The Katie Helper Show is produced by Joshua Bregman, edited by Ted Reedy, and the theme song is by the band Cordova.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.